Case of the day is United States v. Hill. Ms. Babich.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel for the Government. My name is Linda Babich. I represent the appellant in this case, Clayton Hill. Mr. Hill is currently serving a 92-month sentence. Your Honor, he is appealing his 92-month sentence on the basis of two issues. With respect to the second issue that was raised in the brief, the issue of whether the 92-month sentence created an unwarranted disparity with his co-defendant's sentence of 6 months and 13 days, we're going to mainly rest on our brief. I don't think that there's anything further to be touched upon other than she originally had a 46-month sentence, as the government had indicated in their brief. The disparity here, even with the 3553A factors, is quite large, so we believe that the disparity was unwarranted. With respect to the second issue, whether the court erred by increasing the defendant's base offense level by 14 levels as to count 22 for identity theft. For the purpose of oral argument today, we're going to suppose that the government's position that they would be included as a victim for identity theft would be correct. However, if you take the 14 points and add it in, what happens is a double counting issue is created with respect to the fraud on the other count. As was agreed by both parties, the tax fraud was properly calculated under the 2T1.1, and it raised it to a level 22. By making the identity theft, which contains the same exact loss from the same exact fraud, and increasing the level to a level 26, it results in a double counting. In other words, in some instances double counting may be permissible, where we're dealing with an issue of loss and an issue of, for example, an increase for fraud in financial institution. Those kinds of double counting would be permissible, but here, where we're talking about the same loss, we're talking about the same victim, which would have been the government, the loss here, which results in an enhancement, would end up resulting in a double counting for purposes of sentencing.
What text of the guidelines prohibits that?
The case law has said
there is no freestanding double counting rule.
I understand that, but if we are talking about an enhancement that would result, and the case law, I believe, which I cited in VUCO, said that if we have a circumstance that results in an enhancement that comes from, for example, let me take a step back, actually.
Okay. I'm not asking you what case law says, counsel.
I understand.
I'm asking you what the guidelines say, because this idea that there's some sort of free-floating double-counting rule out there is incorrect.
Your Honor,
it's got to be a guidelines textual-based argument. And in some cases, the text of the guidelines prohibits what is colloquially referred to as double counting. And in some cases, it expressly permits it.
At one point in time, I believe the guidelines did permit that. And I think that section has since been taken away. The case law that has developed thereafter has indicated that the double counting would not be permissible in circumstances particularly where you have the same offense. I understand your question in asking whether it exists. I didn't find it, but I'm telling you that what I had found was that where it was previously allowed, it was taken away. And so the section that had previously existed that would have permitted it does not exist anymore, and the case law that's developed from all of the circuits in dealing with this issue has stated that where there are the circumstances such as this one, where you're having an enhancement that would be arising out of the same set of circumstances, it would amount to double counting. I think this court even suggested that, for example, when it dealt with an issue of grouping for a tax fraud, and I believe it was a wire fraud case, a tax loss and a wire fraud case, when it refused to group in the VUCO case, it refused to group the two cases because the tax loss was resulting from the actual fraud. The court suggested, however, if they were to be grouped, that a double counting issue might arise where we are talking about an enhancement that results in a circumstance such as this one. specifically, I think the court had indicated where the specific offense characteristic is found in the other offense characteristic. The other offense characteristic, and both are used to enhance the defendant's sentence, this would result in double counting, and we would have a problem.
I just don't get that. If the district court is applying the proper guideline and applying the proper loss calculation by reference to the government as victim, and you're conceding that the government qualifies as a victim under the applicable guideline 2B1.1, is that a correct statement?
It is a correct statement.
You're conceding that.
I am.
Then, unless the guidelines prohibits somewhere the use of the total amount here that was the intended loss, in other words, the total amount of the tax refunds, then I don't know what principle is being transgressed. There is no free-floating double-counting principle.
But I think the principle, then, it allows the government sort of to pick and choose which counts that ultimately they get to charge or to have somebody plead to.
That's a feature of the federal charging system and the federal guidelines system, and has been for a long time. Nobody has ever thought that to be improper.
I don't think that it should be fortuitous that he's enhanced because you could pick which section. I think in this instance in particular, where all parties agreed that this was a loss that resulted from a tax fraud, the application of 2T should apply. I believe also I think one of the comments in 2T indicates that it should have all relevant conduct encompassed into the calculation of loss under 2T. And if I hadn't said it was comment note 2. And for that purpose, I think that by using 2B1.1 to enhance the sentence, I think you're calculating the loss in two different ways. One enhances it in an impermissible way, and that, I think, is why there has developed this body of law that says if you're going to use an enhancement, it needs to address two separate circumstances. And in this instance, I think it addressed the exact same loss. He's being punished for it in two different ways when all parties have agreed that it should fall under the tax fraud section. So I believe that ultimately does amount to an unfair double counting. And the court itself wasn't sure of the outcome, and he had... Yeah, the judge had spent some time questioning it. So I do believe that if you look at cases like Fuca or if you look at cases like Pham from the Ninth Circuit, the comments there indicate that if you have such a circumstance that it should be.
Ms. Babbage, Judge Gettleman only used one count, though, for sentencing, right? Purposes of sentencing?
Or grouped.
Yeah.
And it was the higher count. It resulted in the section under 2B1.1, which was the 26, level 26, that resulted in the sentence which he received. So I know we have plenty of time, but this is the only issue that we have presented, and so
reserve
some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court, Assistant U.S. Attorney Dylan Smith for the United States. I will go right to this double counting issue, since the appeal seems to have distilled itself into that. And it's the government's position that we don't have double counting here in any sense in which the guidelines are concerned with it. In fact, and I'll get to this, we have what may be close to the opposite of double counting. And what went on here in terms of the grouping of offenses that were governed by different guidelines and produced different offense level calculations is not only something that's not prohibited by the guidelines, but it's expressly contemplated by the guidelines and the commentary. And to calculate Mr. Hill's sentence in this case, the district court basically had to go through two steps. The first step, obviously, is to calculate the offense level for each offense of conviction, each of those two counts, count 1 and count 22. And that step largely has been taken off the table by appellant's concession here. So we can kind of focus on step 2, which was then to apply the grouping rules in Part D of Chapter 3 of the guidelines. And the starting point for applying Part D of Chapter 3 of the guidelines is to know which is the most serious of the offenses. So by the time you come out of what I've called step one, which is calculating the offense level for each of those offenses of conviction, you need to know which one has a higher offense level. And that's why you really do need to run through the analysis separately, as the probation officer and the district court did here, figure out which one has the higher offense level. You don't say that one is already accounted for in one count, and so we don't look at it in the other account. That's putting the cart before the horse or prejudging the issue in a sense. So you turn to Part D of Chapter 3 once you've determined those offense levels. And the introductory commentary to 3D is actually helpful here in pointing out that the most serious offense is used as the starting point. And your first question when you have, as you did here, two counts of conviction is to ask whether they should be grouped. And you look to Section 3D1.2 of the guidelines for that. And when offenses involve substantially the same harm, as the court is aware, they are grouped. Now, it's conceded here, I believe, by both sides that grouping was appropriate. It's probably worth noting that within Section 3D1.2, there are four subsections that provide alternative ways you could reach the conclusion that a couple of offenses involve substantially the same harm. I think here there are at least two of those subsections that applied 3D1.2D because you're looking at a total aggregate harm, but also 3D1.2B, which involves circumstances where you have a common victim and a course of conduct. So you look at those. Here you clearly had that. The whole object of this scheme, even though it's charged in a 41-count indictment, is essentially to steal money from the government by submitting false refund claims. So these two counts group. You then turn to 3D1.3, which tells you, what do I do now that I've put these two offenses of counts of conviction together into one group? How am I going to come up with the offense level for that single group? And what you do in this case, where you've got two counts of conviction governed by separate guidelines leading you to two different offense levels, is you look to the most serious offense. And the commentary to 3D1.3, Application Note 3, actually addresses this explicitly. And it's there talking about when counts are grouped under 3D1.2D, which is the grouping that you have when you have an aggregate total. And what Application Note 3 to Guideline Section 3D1.3 says is that if the counts in the group are covered by different guidelines, use the guideline that produces the highest offense level. And that's exactly what happened here. And there are, I think, two ways of looking at this. We could stop right there. There are two ways of looking at this that help to show that this is not double counting here. And the first is sort of pointed to by the Vukoke case that counsel mentioned. In Vukoke, as is typically the case, the defense wanted the counts to group. And the reason a defendant usually wants the counts to group is that if you don't group and you end up with a couple of separate groups, you're then thrown onto 3D1.4 of the guidelines. And that, you know, takes us into the arcana of the guidelines. But the basic point is the less serious offense is going to give you some incremental punishment. Okay? Here that doesn't happen. So there's no double counting. There's one offense level, as Judge Flam's question pointed out toward the end of counsel's argument. So you don't have double counting in the sense you don't have separate groups. You've got one group and no incremental penalty for the fact that there's a second offense of conviction. The second thing to think about, which just kind of shows that you don't have double counting here, is that, especially given counsel's concession, if the only offense that Mr. Hill had been charged with or pleaded guilty to was the 1028A7 charge, count 22, which is the offense that produced the higher offense level, there is no question that his advisory guidelines range would be what it was. And it can't be the case that being charged or convicted of a second offense actually drags your offense level down. That doesn't make any sense. So we don't have double counting here. What we have is a grouping of offenses exactly as contemplated by the guideline. Unless there are any questions, I don't propose to address the unwanted disparity argument. I'll wrap it up. It's the government's position that the district court correctly calculated Mr. Hill's advisory guidelines range, and in imposing a sentence at the low end of that range, did not abuse its discretion. And so we would ask that you affirm the sentence.
A six-year sentence, basically? Six-and-a-half-year sentence?
92 months, so
seven and a half years sentence. Okay,
that's
seven and a half year sentence.
That's correct, for a $500,000 fraud on the government involving the theft of the identities of more than 120 people.
And no priors?
This defendant actually was a Category 6 criminal history.
Oh.
And to turn to the sentencing disparity argument for a moment, you had a husband and wife conspiracy. Mr. Hill was a Category 6, which, of course, is the highest level under the guidelines. He was a lifelong fraudster.
Right. I misread that.
I think Charles Dickens had something to say about that one time. The law presumes wife is subservient to the husband. The law is an ass. No, a ass.
Well,
there you are.
Happily, the wife is not before us, Judge, so I'll leave that one alone.
That was a twist, if you remember. Poor Oliver lived a bad life, too.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Babbage.
Briefly, Your Honors. With respect to the discussion about grouping, while I appreciate the dissertation about grouping, the issue of double counting, I believe, occurs prior to that point when we're dealing with anything that might enhance the sentence. So the question is not, and it hasn't been, whether these two matters should have been grouped. They arise out of the same conduct. And I think that sort of goes back to our original point. Anything that enhances the defendant's sentence should be from two separate and distinct set of circumstances. This is from the same loss and the same victim. So we believe that the enhancement that resulted under the identity theft would have been double counted.
Doesn't 3D1.3 direct that you take the highest?
I'm not disputing what that actually that comment says. My point to that was that the enhancement then under the identity theft shouldn't have occurred, given the fact that it ultimately resulted in double counting. It creates a problem, certainly. If you're going to enhance it, the question then becomes, because all parties had agreed it should have been under the tax fraud, our position is that the guidelines under the tax fraud should have been used. The loss should have been calculated there and not under 2B1.1.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our right, thanks to all counsel. Ms. Babbage, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appeal. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.